You ever wonder how people climb to the pinnacle of power? In this episode, we're going to talk about Jeffrey Pfeffer's book, Power, Why Some People Have It and Others Don't. And we're going to understand how they do it.
In a world of incompetent bosses, micromanagers, and petty tyrants, one management professor claims that he can help you become the kind of leader that you would want to follow. You are listening to The Leadersmith. Now, here is your host, Darren Gurdis.
Welcome to episode 6 of the Leadersmith podcast. My name is Darren Gurdis, and I am so happy that you could join us. We're starting a new series entitled Read to Lead, where I just talk about particular books. I'm going to be doing this quite a bit from now on. So if you see Read to Lead preface before whatever the topic is, I'm just reviewing the book. Okay, so this week we are going to be talking about the book Power, Why Some People Have It and Others Don't by Jeffrey Pfeffer. Now, I use this in my Power and Influence class, so I'm very familiar with it, and I'm going to go over some of the highlights. Now, Pfeffer is the real deal. He is a professor from Stanford. He's written a number of great books, including The Human Equation, which I used to use in class, and Hard Facts, Dangerous Half-Truths, and Total Nonsense. He also wrote books that I don't like Leadership BS, where he is essentially saying all that stuff, essentially the things that I try to teach you about normatively how leadership should work. He says, no, don't do that. This is how leadership really works. It's kind of like what he's doing here in Power, where he's talking about what is rather than what ought to be as a roadmap to power. So here we'll get into it in the introduction. He talks about why you should want power. So power is related to lots of things like longer, healthier life, job control, decision authority, and discretion to use your skills leads to or predicts heart disease more than obesity and blood pressure, which is pretty remarkable. So if you have control, discretionary control over what you do at work, you have a lower incidence of heart disease and other kinds of ailments that are related to stress at work than if you don't. And that makes sense. So that's how he starts off talking about this. And he starts again with what I just alluded to earlier, beware of the leadership literature. The books teach things like, you know, find your inner compass and be truthful. And truthful is generally a good idea. Be truthful, let your inner feelings show, be modest and self-effacing. He says this is all nonsense. The people that write these books were already using hard-nosed tactics to achieve power, and then they got power, and then they turned around and kind of changed their image. So again, he's calling what follows a roadmap to power. I think you have to be very careful with that and think it might be a roadmap to something else. Okay, this is a quote. He says, for most leaders, the path to power bears little resemblance to this advice. Again, he's not worried about the morality of what he's communicating. He's just saying this is how it's done. He's worried about the actual, not the normative, which is what I'm concerned with, which is what's normative. But if you think about this in real life, actual, you know, if we look around in society, actual is theft and rape and murder. No, I'm telling you, follow the law, be a good citizen, in contrast, by way of analogy. He's talking about the is, I'm talking about the ought. So it's good in one sense, in understanding how the world works or how things have worked, but it's not in the terms of a real roadmap of this is what you ought to do in order to get there. Okay, now chapter one, he says it takes more than performance. And he starts out by saying that as long as you keep your boss or bosses happy, performance doesn't really matter. And he cites a number of studies that tend to show that. Salaries, for example, are tied to tenure rather than performance. And as long as you have a good relationship with your boss, you should be in good shape. He says that executives with poor performance but who had power were more likely to retain their position. Now, that flies in the face of the justice that we would expect in the world. And he says, you know, forget it. Just jettison this idea that the world is just. He also talks about you need to build a power base. He says the surest way to keep your position, and I'm quoting again, the surest way to keep your position and is to build a power base to help those with more power enhance their positive feelings about themselves. So the people that already have power, you're going to enhance them, feel good about that, and that's how you're going to be powerful too. That's called being a suck up. Don't do that. Yes, that might help you become more liked by them and then rise in power first, more quickly. But just don't do that. You don't want to be a brown noser. Okay, chapter two, he talks about the personal qualities that bring influence. He talks about doing an objective self-assessment. And then within that, he talks about seven important personal qualities. And he breaks them into will and skill. And so will are things like ambition and energy and focus. And then he talks about core skills are things like self-knowledge and being reflective. He talks about confidence and being able to project self-assurance. He talks about the ability to read others and to empathize with them. And then finally, the ability to tolerate conflict. Now, these are all important. I mean, these are very useful. I'm not discounting them. He's a little less than moral in the way that he's applying them. But think about it, like ambition will propel you. Energy will sustain you. This is why Trump calls Joe Biden Sleepy Joe. He doesn't have energy. See, so Trump is attacking that particular thing. Focus will help you stay on track. I've never known anybody to be really world-class in the thing if they were just all over the map and couldn't really focus on one thing. Self-knowledge, you understand who you are and who you're not. I mean, what you're good at and what you're not good at. Confidence, you're only going to attempt things if you feel confident in being able to attempt it. That just makes sense. Empathy with others. So empathy in order to walk with their shoes, but just be careful that you're not using it to manipulate others because that becomes its own problem. And then toleration of conflict. Beware that conflict is part of this. I mean, anytime you get into leadership, that's going to be part and parcel of the equation. And then he concludes that chapter by talking about intelligence. Intelligence is somehow we think of intelligence as the key to success. But he says, no, the single best predictor of job performance is intelligence. It only accounts for 20% of the variation, right? So all other things being equal, we want smart people as opposed to dumb people, right? But that's just for job performance. That's not for taking power. So there's a very limited link to power. And part of the reason is that intelligent people, they fail because they think that they don't need anybody else. They think they're smart enough. And so they don't feel like they need to rely on others, and they don't feel like they need manners. I mean, think of people that have been in a position of power that are smart and they know that they're smart. They just tend to be abrasive. Okay. Chapter 3 talks about choosing where to start, and he talks about departmental power. And so the person with the most accurate understanding of the power distribution has power. Relative pay comes from the department that you're in, whether it's high or low. And even in the university setting, right, I teach in the College of Business, that gets more than a college of education, which gets less, and a law school, which gets far more. So it depends on which department you're in. That will have an effect. Your physical location to power. So if you're somehow located, your job is the president heavily relies on you, that gives you power. Positions on committees and assignments, that will give you power as well. So yeah, it's funny because if you're controlling the agenda, like I was watching a documentary because this is kind of what I do. Lenin made Stalin his Secretary General, and we think about our General Secretary was essentially a clerical job, just keeping the agenda and making sure the trains ran on time. But it wasn't really a sought after position within the Communist Party. But he controlled the agenda, and by controlling the agenda, Stalin took power after Lenin died. Okay, and then finally, the core of the office that could also communicate power, like the White House. I found this interesting article that I showed in my classes that Trump was talking about how the White House is kind of a dump. Well, I mean, relative to his gilded apartment in Trump Tower, I mean, if you ever see a picture of it, it's like all overladen in gold. Yeah, it is kind of dumpy. So that's a matter of perspective. But the core will tell you something about relative power as well. Okay, chapter 4, moving on, he's talking about getting into power, and he talks about you must self-promote and put yourself forward. And a lot of people have a hard time with that, and for good reasons, because some of it is not good reason, some of it's just being shy, and then other, it's like, yeah, you don't want to kind of be a jerk. You have to ask for what you want, okay? You can't be afraid of rejection, but he unpacks something, and this is part of the useful part of the book. So when you ask, it's flattering. We don't think about it like this, but when you ask somebody for a favor, hey, can you do this for me? Can you answer this question for me? Can you help me with this thing? You're telling that person, you're one up on me, and by me asking, I'm asking you, I'm acknowledging that. It's flattering. And agreeing to request affirms the grantor's power that I'm one up and you're one down. And so it's just my ring, right? It's something that is that, I mean, psychologically, that's what's going on. So ask for what you want. And people usually want to help you with this. He gives a number of studies showing how, when people ask for favors, how many, for example, how many strangers would you have to ask to borrow a cell phone to make a call? And people guess about 10, but it's really 6.2. So we overestimate how hard it's going to be to get a favor granted. He also talks about building your personal brand and promoting yourself. I alluded to Trump earlier. Yeah, Trump was masterful at this. It was Trump, Trump, Trump. He always would be talking and putting himself in the spotlight. He does this to the media regularly, right? He sends out a 2 o'clock in the morning tweet and he is all over the news. He knows exactly what he's doing. He's promoting himself. Okay, he shifts gears a little bit and he talks about likability as an asset. In general, we like people who are likable, people who are warm and competent, and people that are likable, we want to be around, we want to be like. But competence is enhanced not by likability or kindness or those kind of factors, but by toughness. We think that they're competent not because they're likable, but because they seem tough. And so Pfeffer's message then is, if you want to build power, be mean. I mean, that's essentially what he's saying. He's saying, you know, be tough, and then people will know that you are competent. Okay, but that, you know, you don't have to be a jerk in order to, you know, show that you're competent. You can be competent by the words you speak, even when you're kind. And so my solution is, be hard on problems, but be kind to people. And that, I think that's the way that you should proceed. He said, likability can create power. Power certainly creates likability because it works the other way. Like, people that have power are more liked than people that don't, all other things being equal, just because they have power, which is a really bizarre way that human beings work, but we work that way. So people support perceived winners. His message is, do these things, become a perceived winner, and then you'll create more power. Okay, creating resources. So now he talks about resources that enhance power. Controlling access to money and jobs leads to power. An interesting statistic that he had in the book was that size is 40% of the variation in CEO's pay. So the size of a company, if you work for GE, all other things being equal, as a vice president, you're likely to make a lot more money than if you're a vice president of a small 100-person firm. And that's just because of relative size. Okay, that makes sense. CEO performance only accounted for 5%, which is bizarre because CEO performance is supposed to be, or performance is supposed to be tied to salary, but it doesn't actually tend to work out that way. In the next chapter, he talks about building effective social networks and the task of networking. Now, networking is important and it's often undervalued, but you should really think about networking. Networking takes work, but people don't like engaging in what they perceive to be fake relationships. So don't be fake. If you go network, actually get to know the person, actually find out what they need and see how you can help them. People tend to undervalue these relationships and overvalue other job functions, but that's a mistake. Pfeffer goes on to talk about a number of studies, an Italian study, a German study, a Raytheon study. The Raytheon study, he says, look, these people at Raytheon, they attended this seminar to learn how to network. 35% higher scorers on the evaluations. They got 43% greater likelihood of promotion, 42% less likely to leave. There's a lot of power in networking, but we don't tend to do that because we tend to think it's a lot of hocus. He also talks about centrality. Centrality creates benefits as well. This is like the old school way of thinking about what it meant to be in power. Everything has to flow through me. But when you do that, you become a bottleneck to others. So this is really kind of bad advice for the organization, but it's good advice for you to accumulate your personal power. Don't do it. Okay, so it's just that easy. Don't do that. So centrality probably is helpful to you, but it's in the same way that it's helpful to a dictator. Like, I'm always wondering, like, why a third world dictator would set up a society the way that he does, where everything has to go through him and he has to keep such a tight control. Well, he has to because he has to stay in power. But if he could loosen the reins and free the people and help them merge into the markets, the overall country would be so much better. But no. It's not about them. It's about him. And that's the difference between what he's doing, which is creating centrality for himself, as opposed to what he should be doing. Okay, chapter 7, he was talking about speaking or with power, or if you want to give a better subtitle, how to look powerful. And he gave the example of Oliver North, and he contrasted that with an example of Donald Kennedy. So Oliver North, if you remember, in the 1980s, he's called before Congress. He's in his uniform. He has this righteous indignation when he's lecturing the congressman who was talking to him. He interrupted him, talked right back at him. And we're like, oh, okay, this guy's got something, right? He looked powerful. And then he gave the contrast of Donald Kennedy, who was caught in some scandal. He apologized for wrongdoing. He expressed contrition and, you know, admitted guilt. And Pfeffer's conclusion was, don't be like Donald Kennedy. He looks weak. Well, yeah, but he did the right thing. So you got to take some of this advice with a grain of salt. He also quotes Harriet Rubin, who worked in publishing and with Hollywood. And she said, the secret of leadership was the ability to play a role, to pretend, to be skilled in the theatrical arts. Now, we always have a lively discussion about this when we're in class, because is that really what we want to do? We want to be fakey. And so there's something right about to look the part, but there's something not right about that at the same time. You take that with a grain of salt. Acting with power may start as an act, he says, but it becomes less of an act over time. And I can believe that. That's fair. Emotions and behaviors become self-reinforcing, and emotions ultimately are contagious. Like if I showed you a picture of a little baby smiling, you would smile right now, just because emotions are contagious. So with that, he says, anger leads to looking like you're competent. He says, research shows that people who express anger and are seen as dominant, strong, competent, and smart, although they're also, of course, seen as less nice and warm. So his conclusion, act tough and angry, and you'll be seen as competent. And wouldn't that be great? No, it's not. So don't follow that bad advice. Okay, speak powerfully. This means interrupt more. Okay, now I grew up in New Jersey, and we just interrupt because we speak incredibly rapidly. And that's just when we're engaged, we interrupt. And it's been hard to shake that habit. But if you're interrupting to cause an effect, like the dominant person tends to be the one interrupting. The boss interrupts you, not the employee interrupting the boss. So that is a sign of power. Contest the premises, use persuasive language. I can buy the last two, but the first one's just being rude. Don't be a jerk. Okay, I'm out of time, but come back tomorrow for part two. We're going to talk about the remaining chapters of Pfeffer's Power. Thanks for your time. Talk to you tomorrow.